I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Ryan Patrick Hanley, professor of political science at Boston College. We're discussing his 2020 book, The Political Philosophy of Fenelon, from Oxford University Press, as well as his translation of Fenelon, also in 2020 from Oxford, Fenelon, Moral and Political Writings. Hanley is a frequent guest on the show, prolific author of many books and articles on modern, especially Enlightenment, political thought. Ryan Patrick Hanley, welcome to the Political Theory Review once again.
Thanks very much, Jeff, once again.
Yes, Ryan, it is now your fourth appearance on the Political Theory Review, which is quite amazing. Now, I need to get you like some kind of jacket or something to be in the Fourth Timers Club. But what it really means is that you write a lot of good books, my friend. So congratulations on the books. Yeah, we're talking about two books today. One you wrote and one that you translated. One's on Fenelon and one by Fenelon. And I have to say you've done a really great service here, Ryan, by translating these great texts to make them accessible to English, to an English speaking audience, and also for writing a book about Fenelon that makes an important contribution to our understanding of the author. So well done on both counts. Let me ask you first again, as I always do, what was the motivation for embarking on this project?
Well, first, thanks for the kind words about the books. I really do appreciate that. And thanks, of course, to Oxford, who had the wisdom, and my great editor at Oxford, Peter Olin, who was willing to do this as a twofer and get the monograph and the translation out there. As far as the motivation goes for the project, it was really a perfect storm of a variety of different things. It was in some ways it's a departure from much of the work that I've been doing. Most of my work to this point has all been really mid late 18th century, focusing especially on the Scottish Enlightenment. And this, of course, I've moved back a century and hopped the channel here to work on Fenelon. And so, you know, it was the sort of thing that because that was a transition. It was sort of a mid-career stage move where I got excited to having said a lot about Adam Smith, who I wrote some books about, this was a chance to do something new. And so I got excited about that. But I think the other thing that was also very exciting and led me to this was, in the first place, the fact that it was a really remarkable moment where Fenelon was wonderfully influential, in addition to being substantively fascinating, and is really not very well known today outside of a very small number of specialists. Usually the people that know a little bit about Fenelon are ones that have, in our world at least, have seen the references in Rousseau's Emile or something like that, and know that he's important, but probably haven't engaged him directly. But there was just such a huge disconnect between contemporary knowledge, especially in the Anglo-American world, and his massive influence on the 18th century and beyond, that this was, just speaking as a historian of political thought, something really exciting to find, that there was, in fact, a stone that was still relatively or unturned, and that that at least at monograph length hadn't been worked through. So, you know, when I was in graduate school, I remember very vividly one of our faculty members telling us that there might be some wisdom in moving on to doing contemporary political philosophy rather than history of political thought. At a certain point in time, said this mentor, everything's going to have been seen and said already. And I've thought about that many times over the years. I'm glad I didn't make that move for all kinds of reasons and stuck as a historian of political thought. But the Fenelon experience reminds me that, in fact, that's not entirely true. Even though he's still well known in France, he's not well known in the Anglo-American world. And I think that there was still room for a contribution to be made. And so it was really a joy to be able to work through less charted territory than, of course, the extremely well-canvassed worlds of the other authors I've been working on, Smith, Rousseau, Kant, just a very different beast altogether in that respect, and very exciting then.
Yeah, I mean, of course, in one way, there are, innumerable historical figures that one could uncover and unearth, but the vast majority of them are not going to be worth engaging with, right? The amazing thing is that Fenelon is, and yet that we have not, that it is we in the English-speaking world really don't read this author or have really engaged with him. His influence is quite striking, as I read in your book, and the writings, which I dipped into here and there, are really quite powerful and wide-ranging. So it is really quite striking that there hasn't been really as much engagement with him as with other authors of this period. So I am interested in why you think that is, but maybe before getting into that question, maybe you could just sort of get us started by saying a little bit about who Fenelon is for those who don't know him. Maybe say a little bit about his life and his influence on subsequent thinkers.
Yeah, sure. Of course. Sort of the very brief, in a nutshell sketch. So Fenelon is the latter half of the 17th century in France, one of the towering figures in both intellectual, religious, and indeed political life. So he's born in 1651. He's a member of the aristocracy, and he goes off to a career in the church. And so he makes his formal living as a priest and ultimately as an archbishop. But the path that he took to that route was really terribly fascinating. Maybe the first thing to begin with is right after he gets ordained and he's studying in Paris, he goes on in the early 1680s to become he directs a school called the Nouvelles Catholiques, which is for Protestant girls that are converting for reasons usually of family interest within the state of France, incurring favor with Louis XIV. But he's involved in this very delicate job of managing the conversions of these young Protestants. And that turns out to be a real blessing for him in 1685, when something happened that was a blessing for very few people, especially the French Protestants, which is the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. Once France became, again, officially a Catholic state and many of the Protestants fled, Fenelon was then sent, because he had done such a good job at Nouvelles Catholiques, to the south of France and to some of the Protestant strongholds to continue his work. Again, a tremendously delicate job, to say the very least. But Fenelon was really deeply committed to a gentle form of persuasion. And he succeeded. And he succeeded especially at catching the eye of some of the leading political figures of the day. The governor of the region in which he was working was close to Louis XIV, a relative of the great finance minister Colbert. And as a result, Fenelon gets sort of elevated into court society as a result of his good work there. He's given the position that really defines his political life when he becomes the court tutor within Louis XIV's court in Versailles and Paris. And he's there, the tutor to the enfants de France, the grandchildren of Louis XIV, and who are the presumptive heirs to the throne, given Louis XIV's age. So Fenelon is then all of a sudden welcomed in to the height of the Sun King's court to see firsthand how it works, and indeed is responsible for now educating the presumptive heir to the throne. He does that by, among many other things, writing for the heir, and he writes this novel that we've already had reason to mention before, Telemachus. Telemachus is a book written for an audience of one, for the Duke of Burgundy, his Fenelon's pupil. And the book is formally a story of Telemachus, Odysseus's son, and it's formally a continuation of the fourth book of the Odyssey, and it's Telemachus going in search of his father, Odysseus. But what Fenelon does is he uses this as a way to educate, to provide a story of Telemachus encountering in his travels across the Mediterranean all kinds of political regimes and learning the virtues of rule. And Fenelon wanted to teach his young charge to be, and we can go into more detail on this, but essentially to be an anti-Louis XIV, to rule not for the sake of his own personal glory, as the grandeur and obsession with glory that drove Louis XIV, but to rule for the benefit of his people. So Telemachus was designed to be, in many ways, the education for an anti-Louis XIV, something like what the great historian of political thought, Patrick Riley, called a model of republican monarchism. And what's really interesting about this is that I mentioned this was really a book written for an audience of one. It was written specifically as a manuscript never to be published for the Duke of Burgundy. But in this fantastic firestorm, we seem to think that the real story is that it got leaked. One of Fenelon's valets ended up taking this to a bookseller in Paris, and it sold like hotcakes. It becomes an 18th century bestseller. It influences all these great minds throughout the Enlightenment and the Revolutionary period. And it is what Fenelon owed his lasting reputation for. Just to finish with his biography, most proximately, it also led to his political downfall. Fenelon was, Louis XIV rightly interpreted when he saw this book, that it was directed against him. He was quickly banished from court, and he was sent off to the diocese in the northern part of France, Cambrai, where he was appointed archbishop. It was essentially court exile. And that's where he spent the rest of his days. He wrote extensively on theological and religious works as he, and we can maybe talk a little bit about the great quarrel over pure love and quietism in which he was engaged at Cambrai. But, and we can also talk a bit about his political dealings once he was outside of court. Then he became sort of an outsider resistor rather than working from the inside to subvert Louis XIV. But it really was, when he was exiled then, it really was the change of his life. And he led the last 15 years of his life roughly in political exile in the North, dying in 1715, predeceasing actually Louis XIV just by a matter of months.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I wanted to ask just a little bit more about Telemachus, since it's his most famous book. I mean, in particular, its sort of connection with Machiavelli. One of the things I'm trying to do with, you know, sort of putting Fenelon now on my radar in modern political thought is to sort of locate him in these kinds of stories that we tell about modern political thought. And in particular, one sort of obvious connection, I guess, would be to sort of locate him vis-a-vis the sort of mirror to princes genre that Machiavelli sort of revived and gave a kind of modern twist in The Prince. So Telemachus seems quite different than that, right? It seems to be offering a different model of virtue than in Machiavelli, although Machiavelli does have this republican streak. So The Prince in Machiavelli is better served by sort of attending to the people rather than the elite. So in any case, I mean, what's your view? I mean, did Fenelon have in mind, I guess, first of all, Machiavelli? And second of all, how would you sort of locate Fenelon vis-a-vis Machiavelli in this tradition?
Yeah, it's an absolutely wonderful question. And I think Machiavelli is a perfect point of departure for beginning to understand some of what makes Fenelon so important as a political thinker. First and foremost, I'm not the first to say this, but I think it's absolutely correct, that Fenelon's Telemachus is indeed, and it has to be seen as a mirror for Prince's treatise. As I mentioned, even in the biographical sketch, it literally was written for a prince, and it was quite literally meant to hold up an image of another young prince in the form of Telemachus, and to have him see himself, have the Duke of Burgundy, the pupil, the sole reader of the text, see himself in the adventures, the fortunes, and the misfortunes of Prince Telemachus, who of course was meant himself to rule one day in Ithaca. So for that reason, the text Telemachus has been seen as perhaps the last great installment in the mirror for princes genre, which is of course so important throughout the Renaissance and into early modernity. The difference, of course, is that, as I mentioned before, Fenelon is advocating for a new vision of rulership, new within the context of late 17th century France. Rightly or wrongly, Louis XIV had come to be associated and still remains associated today with the image of absolutism. The idea that, and this is famously captured by Louis XIV's famous l'état c'est moi, right? I'm the state. This idea that his will, ordained by God and by divine right, is what should properly direct all of politics. Fenelon is deeply skeptical towards this, in the same way that he was skeptical towards other forms of strongman rule that he knew, indeed, directly from Machiavelli. So Fenelon wanted to, in many ways, use the Machiavellian genre of Mirror for Princes and to turn it on its head, and specifically to turn it on its head by challenging one of the most famous and central lessons of Machiavelli. And that is specifically the idea that Fenelon is most associated with, and hopefully we can talk in more detail about this, but just to begin, is the concept of love. Throughout his political writings, and especially throughout his religious and spiritual writings, the concept of love is prominent everywhere. And in just in terms of his politics, clearly one of the things Fenelon wants to teach his future king is to have him to become what he calls a pastor of the people, a father of the people. That is very specifically a lover of his people, one who loves his people and is loved by them. That refrain comes up again and again throughout Telemachus and indeed all of Fenelon's many works. And of course, it's anyone who has spent any time at all with Machiavelli will immediately recognize what a challenge that is. The injunction to love and be loved by the people. What an injunction that is to the ruler and how that differs, of course, from some of the most obvious and central lessons of the prince.
Yeah, good. I mean, that's helpful. I mean, it raises another question for me, which is just sort of orienting us here at the beginning, which is, you know, the sort of modernity of Fenelon, which is one of your central claims in the book, that Fenelon is or should be thought of as a modern thinker. Although what you just said about Machiavelli seems to at least to me, to suggest that Fenelon, you know, he's a Christian thinker, right? A medieval thinker. That is, he places emphasis on love and sort of Christian virtues of the ruler and so forth, right? He wants to roll back the clock before Machiavelli, not take the Machiavellian modern turn. So maybe you could just say a little bit about, I guess, why you take Fenelon to have the modern provenance that he does, you know, and why we shouldn't think of him kind of strictly as a Christian thinker.
Yeah, that's great. I'm really delighted that you brought this up because it is one of the things I really wanted to communicate in the book and to push back against a little bit that's been written about Fenelon, which has seen him as very much an idealist and very much an ancient in that respect. We could begin. I love the way that you set it up by framing it in terms of modernity on the heels of Machiavelli, because as we all know, as teachers of or students of the history of political philosophy, there's lots of convenient shorthands in terms of thinking in terms of ancients and moderns and the decisive breaks that are made by, insert your favorite here, Machiavelli, Bacon, Descartes, etc. And we tend to see these things as juxtaposed and as paradigm shifting. And to some degree, that's a very useful way of understanding some of the challenges. But at the same time, where all the really interesting stuff comes in is where that begins to break down. Because modern can, of course, mean a number of very, very different things. And so at least one of the things that I mean to say when I say that Fenelon is modern in this particular text, and this is a side of Machiavelli that I think he is, I don't want to say Machiavellian, but at least is in accord with Machiavelli on this front, is that he is, at the end of the day, Fenelon is, something of a realist. Fenelon is deeply modern insofar as he understands that the world of late 17th century Europe is a world that looks fundamentally different from the classical city-states of 5th century BC, Athens and Sparta, etc., or even the world of Republican Rome, going on down the list. Fenelon understands that there are new political realities on the ground, And even as he's talking about what it looks to have to live in a loving state, he understands that the world of imperialism, of international trade, of constant military engagement and border skirmishes, in terms of serious questions about the balance of power within dynastic Europe, all of these are real, fundamental, living questions that individuals living in late 17th century France would have to figure out for themselves if they hope to create a stable political order. What Fenelon has often been accused of, and it comes from reading, I think, Telemachus and some bits of Telemachus selectively and in isolation from his larger project, is a sort of romanticized wish to go back to a golden age, to use the phrase you used before, Jeff, to turn back the clock and have us go back to an unsullied world, sort of antediluvian world before the flood. I think that's a misreading of Fenelon. For as much as he praises and admires certain elements of, say, agricultural republicanism, he writes extensively and is deeply aware of the ways in which the conditions of this emergent modern world are shaping politics and means that we can never turn back the clock in any sort of naive way. And I think in this respect, we mentioned that it sort of his realism brings him into line at least with one side of Machiavelli. It also brings him in line, I think, with one side, sometimes an underappreciated side, of one of Fenelon's very closest readers, who we've already mentioned in this podcast, Rousseau. Rousseau was a profound admirer of Fenelon. We can talk about that separately. But I think Rousseau, too, it's a huge misreading, I think most would agree, that Rousseau's normative ideal is to turn back the clock somehow and recreate the world of the first part of the Second Discourse and return us to the land of natural savages. Rousseau spilled a lot of ink saying that that was, in fact, not his concern, despite what Voltaire and others accused him of. I think the same thing could be said of Fenelon, who so influenced and inspired Rousseau in so many ways. Even as lyrical as he is, and his descriptions of the Golden Age are really very beautiful, and I translated some of them and tried to do justice to them in the translation. For all his lyrical descriptions of the beauties of this age, Fenelon knew that the question before us was not how to turn back the clock and undo what's been done, but how to work with what we've been given and within the context of modern political realities to recreate to the best of our ability what was good about those, but which can never be recaptured perfectly. So when I say then that he is a modern, what I really mean to say is that Fenelon was someone who understood the realities of imperialism, of global commerce, of the realities of war and balance of power theory, and the need to create virtuous orders that yet occupy that particular space, rather than thinking that somehow we can undo those and ascend to some sort of idealized republic.
Yeah, good. I'm curious about the sort of liberal character or not of Fenelon, but maybe we'll kind of hold that off to talk about the religion and politics chapter they have a little bit later in the book. I'm just in closing out the thinking about sort of introducing this figure. The last question I had was, I think maybe just answered by you, which is the question of why Fenelon turns quite often to the ancients, not just for inspiration, but sort of the setting. I mean, the Telemachus itself, his most famous book, is about a Greek figure. I read through some of the dialogues of the dead, which are quite great. They're really great. I mean, there are dialogues between deceased figures, often ancient figures. So there's a dialogue between Socrates, Confucius, which is just wonderful, sort of, you know, bridging this divide between the West and the East, I guess. But a number of those dialogues are about ancient figures, not often Christian figures. There are a few about that are sort of very contemporary French figures. But so what's your take? Why do you think Fenelon turns to the ancients so frequently in his writings?
I think there's a couple of ways that we can get into that. One is simply as a matter of context. Writing in the 1680s and 1690s in particular, when both Telemachus as well as those really, I love them too, those dialogues from the dead, of the dead, when they emerged. If one thinks simply about what's happening in French literature at the time, and really this is still recognized by the French today as one of the classic high points of their tremendous literary canon. I mean, what was raging at the time? It was quite literally the quote unquote quarrel of the ancients and the moderns. And while in political philosophy circles today, we think that that means one thing and we have that has resonance and associations, it meant really at the time the fight among all these wonderful literary critics, playwrights, poets, many of whose names will be familiar to listeners. What it meant was who were the superior writers, the ancients or the moderns, in terms of matters of taste and style. And while that seems arcane to us today, it was a real living debate. And Fenelon, in many ways, was very admiring of ancient style. And so as ironic as it seems that a priest, Catholic priest, would be so admiring of bloody Homer, he was, as well as especially Ovid and Virgil as well, all of which are influences very easy to find in Telemachus. So I think that that's one very contextual reason. Why? Because this is the frame of reference in which the literary, intellectual, political debates of late 17th century France are happening. And Fenelon, as himself, a member of the Académie Française, one of the great immortals, he couldn't help but couch his own positions in terms of these particular debates. I think also, and I think this also is something that we might want to follow up on, there's, of course, substantive reasons to do this. Fenelon was a profound admirer, among other things, of the political philosophy of Plato, and perhaps most importantly, the political philosophy of Augustine. And these influences run deep throughout his work. And in many ways, I think he is consciously hearkening back to certain sides of their projects and attempting to resist some of what he saw to be the more reductionist tendencies within modernity.
Great. So let's get into some of the topics you address in your book. The book's organized around a variety of features of Fenelon's political philosophy. You know, for example, you have a chapter on education, one on war, the ethics of war, one on statesmanship, and on religion and politics, and on love. And I wanted to take up sort of a number of these to just sort of give some snippet of, you know, the whole of his thought. I thought we could start at your first chapter on it, on education, which is has as the virtue that's associated with it prudence, and takes as its aim educating students towards true glory away from false glory. I think I maybe have that right, the piece is right. So maybe he's going to sort of walk us through his account of education, which I guess, as you pointed out in your biographical sketch, he has a personal connection with thinking about education too. But you could sort of walk us through some, you know, his general theory of education, how he sees the role of rhetoric in sort of achieving this aim of ennobling our desire for glory.
Yeah, I mean, Fenelon's theories of education are themselves really, really fascinating. I mean, some of these come out in Telemachus itself. We haven't yet mentioned, I've said that the novel is really about the prince Telemachus, but he's led in the novel by the goddess Minerva in disguise, who is under the name of Mentor. And so we have this enactment of this pair of Mentor leading and educating Telemachus. It's being written by the educator Fenelon for the grandson of Louis XIV, the Duke of Burgundy. And of course, it would inspire Rousseau, when he wrote his own Emile, and the dynamic of the tutor Jean-Jacques with the figure of Emile himself. And so in addition to formally appearing, and Sophie, of course, is a great reader of Telemachus in Emile, that dynamic of teacher and pupil is something that Fenelon both wrote about extensively and practiced himself in his own pedagogy. So I think that's one important thing to bring up from the outset, because it informs a lot of Fenelon's own writings, as well as his own practice, all of which are geared around a really, this is a very contemporary term, Fenelon doesn't use anything like it, but it's a remarkably child-centric education. The idea that we begin with the child where the child is. We don't try and force things upon them, but we allow the child to express its nature and to be given lessons and to be subtly persuaded in accord with its nature rather than trying to force it to become a certain thing. I hope when I put it that way, some for readers of Emile, that sounds somewhat familiar. I hope it even maybe sounds familiar. I have a friend working on Maria Montessori's theories of education. I hope a bit of that might even resonate with those who are familiar with that approach to child education. Fenelon was really progressive in that way, in trying to bring children along rather than to force them to become something. And questions of play and curiosity and gentle persuasion are all really central to his writings. And for anybody that recognizes how those figure into Rousseau as well, I really commend, and this has been separately translated in a really good translation, his writings on, he wrote a pioneering treatise on the education of girls specifically. And while in many ways it's written for 17th century girls rather than 21st century girls and the unique social role that to which they were confined then, it really is as a study of the human being and how they're educated, really terribly insightful. But I mention all that, I mean, for those of us, you know, participating in this podcast, the issue is really the politics of the whole thing. And the important element of the education for the politics comes back to that thing that you mentioned in your brief gloss, Jeff, when you're introducing the chapter. And that is that, I think, really remarkable distinction between true glory and false glory. And much of Fenelon's persuasive education of the Duke of Burgundy is to get him to appreciate true glory and to weaken his attachment to false glory. Why does that matter so much? And what does it mean? Well, what Fenelon saw when he was living and working in the court of Louis XIV was an obsession with, and anybody that's been to Versailles clearly sees this immediately, the obsession with the egocentrism, the vanity, the splendor, the pomp and circumstance, the gaudiness, all of this external flash. That Fenelon, that was designed to, of course, bring attention to Louis XIV. That Fenelon wanted to say hook, line, and sinker was false. That is simply egocentrism designed to dazzle, as opposed to a certain glory or merit that could be earned by actions, and especially through actions that were beneficial for the people over which the ruler was ruling. So what Fenelon sought to do was not to disabuse the Duke of Burgundy of all love of glory entirely. He in fact thought that would be a little naive. The way politics exists is that, what can one say? People want attention, and especially those in the political world want attention. What Fenelon thought is that that desire for attention, esteem, recognition, for glory, even if it couldn't be extirpated, could at least be elevated. That we could take that desire and channel it from a desire for the wrong sorts of goods, flash and pomp, to the right sorts of goods, esteem, merit, and love for having served the people well. And so as an educator, I think that much of what Fenelon is doing is trying to steer this love of glory, not to get rid of it altogether, but to elevate it and to raise it to nobler and ultimately more politically beneficial goods.
Yeah, and is the idea that the true glory is, you know, more satisfying, whereas the false glory is always, you know, it always leaves us wanting for more? Or is it just, you know, the true glory is better because it's the right thing to do and God said it or some such thing? I ask because it seems, I mean, there is a real connection here with Rousseau, as you've sort of mentioned several times now, that Fenelon even uses the terms amour soi and amour propre, right?
Which is
pretty, so is that is that at work here? I mean, I'm just wondering, sort of lining up, you know, Fenelon and Rousseau in thinking about convincing a student why it is better to have something like true glory rather than false glory.
Yeah, good. Let me preface what I'm about to say by saying that this distinction between true glory and false glory that's really central to the first chapter really becomes an animating theme of the rest of the book. And that one thing I was so struck by working through Fenelon is how significant this distinction between the true and the false is throughout the entirety of his project. He applies it to glory, true and false. He applies it to riches, true and false. He applies it to courage, true and false. He applies it to let me stick with that, because then we're going to go into it. I was about to go into a theological move there, but we can save that for the second half of the book. Suffice it to say that this distinction between true and false goods is extensive in the project. The question then, though, is how does one distinguish between these two different things? That's, of course, on one level, a philosophical question about the difference between the true and the false. And he has much to say about that in his philosophical and his religious writings. But in the first place, one of the things he wants to impress upon the audience of Telemachus, which, after all, the Duke of Burgundy, as far as we can tell from when he wrote it, is a fairly young teenager, maybe 13 years old. He does want to impress upon him questions of satisfaction. And there is a sense of the hedonic treadmill that false glory is insatiable. How much is enough? It's never enough. And he saw this in the form of Louis XIV. However splendid the stables of Versailles were, there was always room to be expanded. How do you know when enough is enough? It's never enough. And so this idea, and I think he really wanted to impress this upon his young charge, first and foremost, from the sake of individual happiness and simply psychological stability, one has to find one's pleasure in something other than the incessant pursuit of ever more external goods that will never in their quantity satisfy. So I think that that is a first point of departure to discuss the difference between true and false, especially when it comes to the question of glory.
Maybe you could say a little bit more about the Rousseau-Fenelon connection, because one of the things I'm wondering about is how much Rousseau sort of draws on Fenelon and where he departs from him. I guess one question, one way to get at it is to think about the theory of human nature that's underlying this. You know, is it for Fenelon, you know, that human beings are sort of naturally attracted to false glory, and so they need this education towards the good, or you know, is there's some other account? I'm wondering, in contrast, you know, Rousseau, these sorts of, this is a sort of artificial desire that emerges, not some kind of natural attraction to these goods. So in any case, I don't know where you want to go with that, but sort of, I'm wondering about similarities and differences here on between Fenelon and Rousseau.
Yeah, no, I think it's a perfect place to go, because not just for the historical reason that Rousseau was such a keen reader and enthusiast for Fenelon, but also because there really are profound similarities, and indeed a tremendously significant, and I think easily enough stated, profound difference. In terms of the similarities, you're right to bring us to that concept of self-love. Rousseau and Fenelon both share this distinction between a variety of different forms of more and less pernicious self-love. And in fact, the very concept of amour propre is central to Fenelon, and especially his spirituality and his religion. In his 18 volumes in the collected works of his correspondence, amour propre is ubiquitous. When people write to him looking to Fenelon for spiritual advice, his consistent lesson is that amour propre leads to unhappiness and that it needs to be transcended. That sounds a lot like Rousseau, the second part of the Second Discourse, and the miseries of the modern citizen plagued by amour propre. In this, they agree. The challenge becomes what exactly self-love represents for both of them, and to use the phrase that you put on the table earlier, Jeff, the concept of human nature. And here there is a simply profound distinction between the two thinkers for all of their many similarities in both moral and political philosophy. And that is, at the end of the day, Rousseau believes that human beings are, and this is the point of departure, as he himself tells us, for his entire system, naturally good. That position cannot be accepted by an Augustinian of the sort that Fenelon is. Human beings are fallen for Fenelon, and that is, again, the point of departure for his entire political philosophy. for every point of agreement between the two in their diagnoses of the pathologies of amour propre, one of the important points of distinction is, and I think that this is absolutely central to Fenelon, and we can talk more about Rousseau perhaps, but for Fenelon, amour propre represents the state of our fallenness, and it will not, through human institutions, ultimately be absolved. It is, within the city of man, within the earthly political regime, an emblem of our fallenness and something that we have to work with and to try to mitigate. But the remedy for that does not lie in the recovery of a state of nature or a human nature that is necessarily naturally good. It lies rather in the transcendence of the self and ultimately the unity with God that is the ultimate aim of pure love for Fenelon. So there we have, I think in a nutshell, that's the easiest way to put the profound distinction between the two, the question of fallenness versus natural goodness. Yeah, I can leave it there.
Yeah, no, that's really well put. I mean, I'm wondering then, I mean, this is getting off topic, I'm sorry, but you know, I mean, me and Rousseau were, why you think then Rousseau was so attracted to Fenelon? I mean, that seems like a big difference, right? The difference over human nature. Why was Rousseau so attracted to Telemachus and the Emile?
I think there's actually a lot of ways to answer that. One is, you know, I mentioned how significant that true-false distinction is for Fenelon. For Rousseau, who I take to be deeply sincere when he says, dedicate life to the truth, I think that trying to understand what exactly that might mean, I think that Fenelon had a great deal of guidance for him on that particular question. I think there's also something else that should be said about Fenelon's reputation, is that Fenelon... there's this remarkable transformation of Fenelon that happens in the Enlightenment in the later 18th century. And that is, as I've been emphasizing throughout, and I think that this is just central to his identity, his self-conception, and his thought as a whole, Fenelon is, first and foremost, a Catholic, a believer, an archbishop, someone who's working within the context and the confines of the church. And that is his... to say it's his self-identity would be minimizing the profound ways in which it shapes his entire thought and being. Fenelon gets transformed by the thinkers of the Enlightenment. I mean, and the evidence for this, anyone who go to Paris today and see on the Pantheon of the Pediment, or the Pediment of the Pantheon, the image of Fenelon standing among the revolutionaries there and appearing as one of them. Now, from all we know about Fenelon's adherence to the church and to dogma, would he ever be able to accept much of the religious transformation? Of course not. What it takes is a secularization of Fenelon and his thought and a transformation of these theologically grounded concepts of love and pure love to see how they might resemble concepts that we know from the later 18th century in the Enlightenment, concepts such as humanity, benevolence, the ideals of humanitarianism that Rousseau himself expressed in the form of pity. So I think that Rousseau, and he's certainly not alone in this, but many other later admirers of Fenelon, including figures ranging from people like Godwin and Bentham to Montesquieu, it required a certain cognitive dissonance to be able to separate Fenelon himself and all of those wonderful humanitarian projects that he himself lived and defended in his thought from some of the first order metaphysical groundings in religion that either weren't available or were even indeed distasteful to certain thinkers of the Enlightenment. So I think that again needs to be brought into the picture here. I actually think that Rousseau's religion is fascinating and very complex. I'm not the one to write the book on this, but I know that someone is going to write a very good book developing this particular idea of the richness of Rousseau's own spirituality and religion and theology. But it's not indeed Fenelon's, I think it has to be said. And in terms of that division between orthodoxy and heterodoxy, there really is a divide between what Fenelon came to be seen as by the revolutionaries and the later Enlightenment, and I think how he would have understood himself in all the richness of his project in the context of the late 17th century.
Yeah, good. The next topic on economics that you take up, there's also a sort of connection to Rousseau here in the sense that it's Fenelon Lovell's a very famous critique of luxury. I'm sorry, and embraces moderation, and really kicked off a dispute about luxury. I take it from your book and influenced Mandeville to respond to him. So maybe you could say a little bit about his view of economics and. Maybe say, I mean, part of the, I think the, you know, nice contribution of your book is to point out here as elsewhere that Fenelon is not really a utopian or idealist thinker, that even despite his critique of luxury, he still can nonetheless find a way to reconcile himself to the real conditions that, you know, of luxury in modern European states.
Yeah, great. I mean, and this is one of the things, to go back to a point you raised right at the beginning, what drew me to Fenelon. I mean, as someone who had spent a lot of time reading and working on Adam Smith, seeing Fenelon's very early defenses of free trade within the context of the incipient luxury debate, that was, I thought that deserved attention. Now, to give credit where credit is due, Jeff, you mentioned that idea of Fenelon being at the headwaters of the luxury debate and influencing Mandeville and then a whole train of thinkers on down after Mandeville. That idea, we really owe very explicitly in Anglo-American scholarship, even though French scholars have been writing on this for some time. Really, that came out very clearly and very beautifully in a wonderful piece written by the late Ishvan Hunt of Cambridge, who in the Cambridge History of 18th Century Political Thought wrote a wonderful piece on the early Enlightenment debate, where Fenelon really stands at the headwaters. And I think that that's absolutely right. And I think Hunt deserves a lot of credit for reestablishing Fenelon's place in inspiring a lot of reactions and counter-reactions by major Enlightenment thinkers. And I don't think we appreciated that all that well until relatively recently. That said, I push back in the book against some of Hunt's interpretation. For Hunt, Fenelon stands not just at the headwaters of the luxury debate, but also as a representative of one very hardline side. And that is a side of the debate that is not just anti-luxury, but indeed is really animated by an obsession with austerity, with the sort of classical republican idealism towards virtue and suspicion of wealth, the sorts of things that animated a much earlier generation of civic humanism. And that I'm suspicious of, I have to say. Hunt goes so far as to suggest that in Fenelon's sort of classical republican agrarianism and his suspicions of commerce, that he goes so far as to anticipate, Fenelon does, some of the worst tragedies of the 20th century. And he even associates, Hunt does, Fenelon with Pol Pot and Chairman Mao. And, I don't think so. I mean, there's so much that could be said about that. But in the book, what I try to do is make the argument that that's a little much. That, in fact, the interesting story here is that Fenelon was undoubtedly skeptical towards the corrosive, corrupting effects of a certain love of wealth. And indeed, he wanted to regulate trade policies in such a way that that certain types of sumptuary laws could be enforced. But at the same time, that looks dramatically different from, or I should say that alongside this, Fenelon is arguing for, in both Telemachus and his other writings, freedom of trade, especially in necessary goods as opposed to superfluities. He's a real believer in mutual gains through trade internationally. He's deeply suspicious of the mercantile regime that has been set up by the finance minister Colbert. And he is, it's too strong to say that he's a laissez-faire liberal. I mean, those sorts of terms, I think, really aren't helpful for almost any 18th century thinker. But he's really a friend of freedom of trade and one who sees the lives of ordinary consumers and ordinary actors, and indeed the poorest among the French of the age, as the ones who stand to benefit from liberalization of certain trade policies and commercial policies. So I think, I mean, you know, death squads and resettlement in the countryside beside, I think that makes him really very, very different from the sorts of tragedies that are all too familiar from the totalitarian movements of the 20th century. And so I really do want to rescue Fenelon a little bit from that, but really to show that he has a much richer conception of commercial realities. And at a very early stage, really, you know, this is nearly a century before the Wealth of Nations, and at a time when not many French political economists had robust theories of free trade, Fenelon's really pioneering in understanding the mutual gains that can come from it and the ways in which mercantilism has been beneficial to elites, but has caused the great mass of French people to suffer horrifically.
Right. I recall in your chapter, I mean, it's interesting reading of Telemachus, because, you know, the haunt type reading, you know, just emphasizes, you know, in a one-sided way, just certain of the tendencies in the way that Fenelon portrays the good political society. But, you know, say in Telemachus, Telemachus has walked through a number of visions of the good society, right? So isn't it, is it Egypt, or I'm not remembering exactly which regime it is that, you know, portrays, you know, a kind of commercial republic that's possible. I mean, I don't know if you want to sort of touch on that briefly, but
yeah, sure. I think the one that you have in mind is probably the Phoenicians, who represent and really, even as Hunt himself notes, these were really a sort of stand-in for the contemporary Dutch Republic, the Dutch commercial republic. In many ways, they really are some of the heroes in terms of the good regimes within the text of Telemachus. But this is one of the things I really love so much, and which is why I think there's been so many interpretive battles in the Francophone scholarship, especially over what Fenelon really meant to say. I mean, you can find almost any position attributed to Fenelon. Realist versus idealist, protectionist versus free trader, ancient versus modern. The real challenge comes from what I think is the fun work as an interpreter and a reader of political philosophy, which is, how do you put all the different normative visions together into a coherent package? And what I tried to do in the excerpts from Telemachus that I translated for the translation volume was to just simply give the sketches of, I think it's about 7 or 8 different regimes, places, physical places, that Telemachus visits and witnesses firsthand. None of these look like the others. They're all very different. We mentioned commercial Phoenicia, which is an international trading empire. But he also visits, for example, the famous people of the city of Betique, who live without money, in which all goods are in common, and which seem to be at a different stage of civilizational progress. Fenelon himself says that they live in a golden age, but he celebrates them as also paragons of virtue. And indeed, we know that that portrait, I mean, this should sound familiar maybe to other readers of Montesquieu, who will know of his troglodytes in the Persian letters, and even various points within Rousseau's vision. But what I think makes, here's where the real work is, and what I try and do in the book, is to show not to pick and choose these visions and to say that this is the real normative vision and these others don't contribute, but to do the work of trying to explain, how could Fenelon be attracted to various different regimes that on their face seem incompatible? What's the logic that holds these together? And I actually think that that's the sort of work, in some ways, I was prepped to do by my own work and study of we keep coming back to Rousseau. I mean, Rousseau famously gives what seem to be incompatible normative visions of excellence, especially of moral excellence and political excellence. The ideas of the natural savage does not look like the solitary walker, does not look like the young boy Emile, does not look like the citizen of the social contract. But on some level, all of those are, I'll use a value neutral term, admirable to Rousseau. How do they hang together? Well, a lot of ink has been and will continue to be spilled on that by Rousseau interpreters, myself included. But I think that that sets up, or at least it set up for me, the challenge that comes out within Fenelon himself. How do all of these different portraits of the good regime contribute to a consistent image of the good? And most importantly, how did they help inform Fenelon's own practical project for political reform. We haven't mentioned yet, but one of my very favorite pieces of all of Fenelon's writings are these remarkable set of plans of government that he wrote in the form of tables. Much later in his life, in 1712, when it looked like Louis XIV was about to die and there might be a new heir to the throne, he and his fellow aristocratic resistors and reformers laid out in about 8 to 10, I can't remember the exact number now, folio pages, all the institutions that they would reform in France. And each one of, I worked through the manuscript while I was at Saint-Sulpice in the archives in Paris, and you see on each page, it's headed church, nobility, commerce, military. And he just goes through with these bracketed columns saying, here's what's going to be different. And there you've got a fascinating practical scheme of reform. And I think we have to understand Fenelon's normative vision within the scheme of those larger concerns he had for political life as lived. And I think that that helps us resist maybe saying, aha, what he really loved was Bétique, and that leads us to Cambodia or something like that. So one of the goals in both the translation and the monograph is to try and give that more sort of fleshed out, fuller picture, and to ask, how do all these different normative visions coalesce?
Good. Yeah, so let's shift over to his view of politics. You have a chapter on that, which is about statesmanship in particular. And again, here, Machiavelli, I think, is the foil. We already mentioned, talked about it that at the beginning. Maybe I'll ask a question about in this way, which is, I think, one way that you frame the chapter, which is that Fenelon, it seems what he's getting at some places is to think about politics in terms of ethics. That is, how can I improve the moral character of the ruler? And then that would make the society better. And that seems like somewhat of a kind of naive approach to politics. But as you point out, there's a kind of much more sophisticated way that the ethics and politics interact. So maybe you could just kind of walk us through that and how Fenelon thinks about statesmanship and good statesmanship.
Yeah, sure. I really appreciate the invite to take up the more sophisticated way. But actually, I would stick with the more naive way for a second that you just described here, because I think that actually there might be, I dare say, a little bit of contemporary relevance.
Right.
One of the things that Fenelon worries most about, and he's got these wonderful portraits of the tyrants when Telemachus visits the underworld in the afterlife. And he sees some are the happy rulers in the Elysian field, and some are these tyrants who live in the pit of Hades and are being punished for their rule on earth. And all of them are united by a very common flaw, which is they succumb to their pleasures and indeed to their false pleasures. And they were driven, these tyrants, and this is familiar to anybody that's read the later books of Plato's Republic, the idea of this obsession with all of these different concerns with pleasure, whether they come in the form of mistresses, or they come in the form of excessive wealth, or they come in the forms of military glory and territorial expansion. Succumbing to these deeper, darker loves is what unites all of these. And Fenelon, again, he's sophisticated enough that he knows that rulers will want to gratify their loves of pleasure. But there's better and worse ways to do this. It's not wrong to want to have a positive reflection of oneself and to enjoy even the adulation of the crowd. But to be obsessed simply with the size of the crowd, as opposed to the question of whether the crowd is cheering you on for having done something good or having pandered to their to the least and lowest of their passions. That's what Fenelon wants to instruct us in. And that strikes me as, to put this in the most general terms imaginable, that strikes me as a lesson that's, it's not a complex lesson. It's certainly not the most complex lesson that Fenelon wants to teach, but it's one that's still worth hearing today, very much so.
There's more to plumb in the political side of things. I mean, maybe the bridge is this. I'm curious about sort of the liberal character, whether there is a liberal character to Fenelon, and this I think will bridge the sort of political and religious sections of the book. And I mean, on the statesmanship question, of course, you know, sort of the, sometimes the liberal answer is to think in terms of, you know, how to design institutions so as to sort of channel self-interest in the right way. And it doesn't seem like Fenelon has much to offer there, although maybe I'm wrong. And then and on the religious question, I guess we'll get there, but the sort of the question of toleration, but maybe we could just start with, you know, the liberal, your sense of the kind of liberal provenance, or whether, you know, how liberal a thinker one might think of Fenelon.
Yeah, that's, I think it's a great question, and it's one that's come up a lot. And I find that, much like the work that I've done on Adam Smith, people like to claim certain figures from the history of political philosophy for their own ideologies, you know, Smith is not immune from that, neither is Fenelon. And when I talk to other people about him, some who like liberalism and like Fenelon see him as a liberal. Some who like Fenelon and don't like liberalism see him as an anti-liberal. That suggests more than anything, I think, just the breakdown and the limits of the idea of the concept. Fenelon is probably not a liberal insofar as a liberal would require some sort of robust defense of the good of freedom or liberty specifically. And I think that one would look in vain for a robust defense of that in Fenelon. Not to say that he doesn't value freedom, far from it. But anything that looks like classical liberal images of freedom and defenses of that from natural right, you know, he's writing at the same time, exactly contemporaneous with Locke, but he's not writing in Locke's idiom, and he's not defending virtuous government from that standpoint. But where he does, I think, share concerns with Locke, just to stick with that for a little while longer, is the deep liberal worry about illiberal abuses of power. And even though his mechanism is not simply to put up, he's not a popular sovereignty theorist, and so he lacks a lot of Locke's institutional and constitutional mechanisms, but he's deeply concerned, as concerned as Locke is, with limiting the power of arbitrary rulers, absolute rulers, especially to perpetuate harm on the people that they're charged of ruling over. And so, you know, I actually think there's a great story to be told about the development of French and Anglo-American liberalism using these divergences in the 1690s, Fenelon and Locke as a point of departure. But many others, Helena Rosenblatt most recently, have written very fine histories of liberalism, and I won't be the one to supplement that. But I think Fenelon has a place in that story, not because he has all the same solutions or is even working necessarily towards the same positive vision of liberty, but because he shares very deeply a worry about authoritarianism and illiberal abuses of power. And indeed, that might be the reason more than anything else, I think, that he really can continue to speak to our age.
Yeah. But is he a theorist, say, of the rule of law? Or is it, you know, he has a vision more of a sort of personalist, you know, character of political community?
Yeah. Interestingly, the area worth exploring is his theory of what he himself describes in various texts as the law of peoples. He does understand that there are both universal norms that rulers have to adhere to. And he's also very explicit in saying that the ruler himself within the framework of his own domestic regime is bound by certain laws. One of his great formulations in one of the texts that I translate for the volume, his Examination of Conscience, Fenelon asks the Duke of Burgundy, or he puts it to him in these terms, that the ruler has his hands free to do good, but they're bound, and he is subordinate to the people as soon as he wishes to do evil. Now, that requires explication, of course, and defining what exactly good doing and ill doing look like. But I think it's not unfair to say that he's working with a concept of the rule of law, even if he's not, and the limitations of power before the law, even if he's not putting it in the same sorts of idiom that is familiar to us from Anglo-American liberalism and its tradition today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the sort of justification of political rule, I take it at bottom, you know, this is not a consent theory. It's not a rights theory. Yeah, the basis is sort of, you know, the virtue of good, you know, good government for the common good provides a basis for rule, right? A sort of natural hierarchy of justification. Is that right? Or, I mean, I'm trying to, think through sort of the basis and thinking about the basis of political rule here.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that has to be said, and maybe this would be helpful to pick up again with Locke here in the contrasts. I mean, one of the reasons why I think Locke speaks to our world and Fenelon has more difficulty speaking to our world is that Locke, of course, not only did he, as a matter of history, undergird a lot of the thinking of the revolutionaries in the American regime, but he gave a defense of the right of revolution that undergirds a certain sense of democratic legitimacy that remains important today. Fenelon is not a theorist of revolution for all of the embrace of him by the revolutionaries. Fenelon was thinking very much in terms of how to create a just, loving, and virtuous political order within the context of a monarchism that he assumed would be perpetuated. And so, again, this goes back to that realism of working with what one has been given. There's no suggestion within Fenelon that we should try to pull the rug out from the monarchy and create alternative systems of government. There is some sense of rebalancing the powers and the estates between the aristocracy and the monarchy in particular, but it's working within that tradition rather than laying theoretical foundations for a dramatic shift of tradition. And I think that as much of an admirer of Fenelon as I am in many ways, I think it has to be said that for that reason, certain of his concepts simply won't have legs. And we can't try and read back into him certain concepts that I think he would have found inimical, quite frankly, the idea of especially wholesale popular revolution, even as he's a very sincere friend of increasing the quality of living for the least well off.
Good. So let's conclude by talking about his view of religion and love, which is really central to his view. I thought, sort of following that bridge with thinking about his view of religion and politics, there seemed to me to be something of a liberal character here in the sense that Fenelon seeks to employ at least religion to check political ambition. This is a way to sort of limit political rulership, and indeed to keep religion and politics separate so that religion can serve this function, so that it can limit politics in that way. I mean, I guess first question is that a right way to think about it? And the second question is, does it go the other way too? Does Fenelon seek to make sure that religion stays pure by staying out of politics, that it gets corrupted as it gets into politics?
Yeah, no, I think this is, again, one of the fascinating areas in which Fenelon is following along a certain liberal path, but he's developing it in an idiom that is either frustratingly or perhaps refreshingly different from the ways in which we tend to talk about these things today. And the idea of separation of church and state is, in fact, fundamental to Fenelon. And he really is invested in maintaining the daylight between these two different institutions. It should be said that he does insist, and part of his education for the future ruler is for the ruler to be a believer. He really does believe that faith has, among the many other things it has, a salutary role in checking certain propensities within the potentially illiberal ruler. But just in terms of the institutional framework, Fenelon really does believe that both the church and state will operate maximally, beneficially, if indeed they're given their own separate spheres of influence and the oversight of each other is minimized, except on certain very certain delineated ideas. You know, part of the background, of course, for this is that Fenelon and Louis XIV are engaged in a very important moment in the history of the French Church. The debate about the status of the French Church vis-a-vis Rome, the political and ecclesiastical authority of the French king vis-a-vis that of the Pope, This gave way, I mean, the context of the debates are some very serious debates about Gallicanism, the autonomy of the French church, and the ultramontanes who are looking to supreme power of the papacy, or the higher power of the papacy. All that is in the background here, and it would take a lot of detail to work through that. I think the important point here is that Fenelon sees a salutary check on illiberal power by an independent church, but he really does want the church to be primarily dedicated towards ecclesiastical functions and to have absolute independence within that sphere. And that's just a fairly forward-thinking degree of separation that certainly was striking to many of Fenelon's contemporaries.
Yeah, so the final chapter that you have on, is on love, which certainly has a religious character, Christian religious character to it. And, well, of course, you wrote a whole book on love, so you're well-versed in this topic. I was curious about, maybe you could say a little bit about love, which for Fenelon plays a role in thinking about the highest kind of life for human beings, and in some ways is somewhat trans-political in the sense that, you know, Fenelon doesn't really think that the political ruler can perfectly embody love. It serves as a kind of ideal point. But I guess one of the questions is, does love, you know, stand in some, this higher perspective of the saint, say, is there an essential tension between pure love and the city, like you see in, say, Plato, the tension between the philosopher and the city, or is this something that's a kind of lodestar that can always inspire the political ruler?
Yeah, that's great. And a huge question that I know, especially as we're coming up on time. Let me try and do the best I can to boil down the essential issue here. And I like the way that you frame it there in terms of the place of love within politics. And I think that, I mean, sort of just to be as blunt and to lay it out as simply as possible, Fenelon, much of the dynamic of his thought as a whole is indeed a tension, to use the word you just used, between, on the one hand, self-love, amour propre, as we've been discussing, and pure love, which is undoubtedly the ideal that he celebrates in his spirituality and believes that human beings should rightly strive towards. The difference between those, the difference between a life lived devoted to the self and the concerns of the self, and a life lived devoted to pure love, and specifically by which he means a disinterested love of God, the difference between those is profound. And it's profound enough that Fenelon, I think it's fair to say, sees these two loves as inhabiting two different spheres. And I mentioned at the outset, we talked a little bit about Fenelon's Augustinianism, but I think that's especially appropriate here. For Fenelon, the political world, as much as he wanted to do to redeem it and to attempt to elevate it, knew that it's not capable of redemption in the fullest sense. The political world will always be a world to some degree of self-love. The achievement of a fully disinterested love only comes with the beatitude, as he describes it, when one is a transcendent of the self and has become fully unified to God. That requires, to say the very least, a way of living and a certain dispensation that takes the human being into a world very separate from the political world. So I think there is, at the end of the day, a real, again, to come back to your word, rightly used, tension between these two different images of the world. One, the city of God, and the other, the city of man, to use the familiar Augustinian terms. How those interact is as complex a question in Fenelon's system as it is in Augustine's. But I think that that basic insight, that there are, in fact, two worlds, with complex systems of interaction between them, but two worlds that are governed by two different loves that ultimately are occupied by practitioners and who embody two different types of excellence. You mentioned briefly the image of the saint, and I think that that ideal is in fact a real ideal of pure love and of a certain type of human excellence, which is an ideal that's very different from even the genuinely excellent statesman who operates efficiently and beneficially for the city of man. And so one of the things that I think is remarkable of Fenelon's genius is that he's not an either or guy. He doesn't force us to see politics as ultimately low and only celebrate the world of the transcendent spirituality. But neither does he elevate politics above the realm he thinks it should occupy. It has a place in the world. We have to understand its place. And that place is, in very important ways, distinct from the type of excellence achieved by those who, through the operations of God's grace, experience pure love to the fullest.
Yeah, I mentioned your book, Love's Enlightenment. I mean, is there a way, you know, if you had to rewrite that book, would Fenelon find a place within it? Or maybe to ask the question a different way, what part do you think Fenelon could play in that story of the development of view of love into modernity?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So I published Love's Enlightenment in 2017, though it was done a little bit before that. And just for various reasons, took a little time to materialize. Mostly it had to do with cover art, which is its own
always an important question. Yes.
Yeah, right. But one thing that I wanted to do, but thought I needed a lot more time to do, was to write the 17th century version of that book. I mean, that book was really focused on four 18th century thinkers, David Hume, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Adam Smith, and Kant. And Fenelon opened me up to a very interesting period of transition between the proper start of early modernity in the 17th century and everything that came later that's been the focus of my work to now. So would I rewrite Love's Enlightenment now? No, but I have been opened to a new and fascinating world that I think demands our engagement in order to fully understand, as well as I want to understand, what is really significant about the Enlightenment proper in the 18th century. And so, I'm really excited for this fall. I'm offering a graduate seminar on Descartes, who is not, a sort of canonical thinker within political science departments, such as the one in which I teach. But Descartes is himself a wonderful bridge between antiquity and modernity, who was both very influential for Fenelon, but also opens up a number of those questions about the transition between antiquity, the Christian world, and what we have come to understand as the modern world, in ways that I think are much more sophisticated than at least I had given them credit for before. And so I see the Fenelon Project as helping to sensitize me to certain things and to continue to reach back into the French 17th century to understand it on its own terms, but also to better understand many things that I assumed that I had understood about the 18th century. I'm eternally grateful that we have, that we operate in the scholarly world in which we do, in which we can continue to explore these questions. But I have a feeling that the next work will be something that looks a little bit like 17th century version of Love's Enlightenment, starting with Descartes, working up through Spinoza, and spending a particular amount of time with figures like Malebranche and Shaftesbury. There's so much more for me to learn about these figures that book might be a little while away. Hopefully, though, that God willing, that the Political Theory podcast will still be kicking by the time I finish that.
Yes, right. Well, Ryan, at your pace, that a long way away is like a year for the next book to come out. But again, can't wait for that. And, thanks, Ryan. I mean, it's been a great conversation, but just in general, thank you for the contribution here to introduce this much deserved thinker to an English speaking audience. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'll return the thanks. I think that I've always thought that Political Theory Review is doing a great service to expose all of us. I mean, we live in a siloed world in political theory in many ways, and I've really appreciated all the efforts you've made to span the gamut of different approaches. So thanks very much for everything you've done, and for very kind of having me back. It's really been a blast as always.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.